This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with SG2 experts and industry thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. We're always looking for new ideas and topics from our listeners, so please reach out, share your ideas. You can email us at sg2perspectives@sg2.com or connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can find links to all that in the show notes. Now, on to this week's episode. Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. We're your hosts, Trevor Durin and Kelly Richard. And today, our first episode of 2021, we have a panel of SG2 experts back to weigh in on what we expect from 2021. As always, there's plenty of uncertainty with a new administration and economy on pretty unsteady, uncertain footing, and a workforce that's more stressed than ever. And at the same time, volume projections need to span a wider range of scenarios, short and long term. So we've brought in Bill Woodson, Jennifer O'Connor, and Henry Sock. Today, we're going to ask them to take what we learned in 2020 and think about what that's going to mean for 2021. Bill, I'll go to you with a real softball question here. What's going to happen in payment and policy in 2021? We have unified government. Healthcare was maybe the place where the Biden campaign had really ambitious goals. What might get done in 2021?
Look, there are a lot of other pontificators out there, and our members are health systems. Despite the aspirations of the incoming administration, they're going to have their hands full with the pandemic. So as we look to the later part of the year, what might move forward, I think we'll see some incremental moves through the regulatory process and maybe budget reconciliation to expand coverage. Not the grand effort to do Medicare for all or a public option. I think there will be ways through the tax code and other means to extend coverage, either through Medicaid or some other means, to some of the states that have not expanded Medicaid. We've spoken to several CFOs about this, that the journey towards risk-based payment to continue, particularly this year with radiation oncology, there should be no change. I think most CFOs expect that to continue to accelerate. We'll continue to see Medicare Advantage expand its roles. We'll see what the numbers are coming out of open enrollment. The transparency conundrum will be bewildering to providers and patients this year and consumers as prices begin to be published. But we should expect some level-headedness around dealing with the financial distress of many health systems in the country, particularly in rural areas and inner cities. As states try to shore up Medicaid budgets, there might be some relief there and some sort of stimulus that's passed in the first couple months of the year. And I think we should expect the blue states to be somewhat activist in looking at antitrust and pricing. Are big systems good things for how states are viewing healthcare right now? Lots of other smaller things around drug pricing and other policy issues. But as a provider, keep your focus on risk and hopefully some financial relief for hospital health systems and states.
Great, Bill. And I want to focus in and expand upon your thoughts about the financial distress and responding to that, as well as the fact that health systems, to relieve some of that, really need to find growth. Looking at everything that has occurred in 2020, what do you think M&A will look like over the next couple of years?
As we look at the last part of 2020, there clearly was some pent-up demand or deal flow going on, and we saw some big ones. And it's interesting to see the announcement of CHI Franciscan and Virginia Mason. We should expect the M&A landscape to continue as it is. Big deals, medium-sized deals. Obviously, there are some distressed organizations out there. There are organizations trying to maintain their bond ratings. Let's just look at the numbers, what we have right now. We have 22 health systems that are between $1 and $6 billion in revenue. We have 17 that are between 7 and 17. We have 8 that are greater than 18 billion. We're going to have more activity clearly in certain regions of the country. And it's a good spectator sport. We should also watch M&A activity in the payer sector. So we've had recent announcements with Harvard Pilgrim and Tusk coming together, Centene and Magellan coming together. And given the changes in the digital landscape, let's watch the M&A activity in the post-acute space pretty closely, particularly in home care. That strikes me as an area to pay attention to. But what does this mean for you? We push back on health systems. You still have the challenge of achieving the benefits of scale in the local market to deliver a better clinical product at a lower price point.
Absolutely. And Henry, do you have something to share maybe about freestanding imaging?
Sure. Thanks, Kelly. What we saw in the last year, we know that the imaging business for most organizations is a high fixed cost business. We know that reimbursements for outpatient imaging have been depressed for the last several years. And once COVID hit, we saw that the reduction in imaging volumes that happened starting in March and probably through the end of September, when we started to see a rebound of things, has had an impact on the outpatient imaging center market. At the top of this year, there were 13,258 outpatient imaging centers. freestanding imaging centers in the United States. More than 10,000 of those were imaging centers that are not part of a hospital or another facility. The data that I saw at the end of 2020 indicated that about 1,000 of those had closed. My conversations with SG2 members starting at the end of last year and moving into the first couple of weeks of this year have been with our health system members around the opportunity to purchase some of those imaging centers. So we've been talking with them about how do you take advantage of potentially joint ventures? How do we accelerate access points for outpatient imaging? And can you take advantage of the depression in the marketplace to be able to add to your portfolio of imaging services? And I expect that we'll see that continue for the remainder of this year.
Yeah, really interesting that the health systems are sort of taking on a position of strength when those freestanding imaging centers have traditionally been competitors and kind of chipping away at the edges of their margins.
Yeah, that's true. And some of the for-profits like Smart Choice MRI, which was making a big move to go national, ultimately ended up going out of business. And the assets were purchased by some of the investment health systems that invested in that over the long term. So I think there's opportunity for our health system members to capitalize on some softness in the marketplace and acquire some of those resources at a fairly attractive price.
As M&A deals happen in individual markets, it kind of reshapes competition. One of the exciting things in 2020 dealing with the pandemic was traditional competitors coming together to do some level of regional and local planning and having great success there. That was exciting. I think 2021 is going to see a swing back to heightened levels of competition, but there's going to be some kind of new front lines in the competitive landscape, right?
Right, Trevor. You're going to see a very local, very intense battle around market share. We are still looking to recover from the volume dip in 2020. Organizations have a real short-term focus right now. They are talking about growth in the next 12 months. They are talking about priorities for the next quarter. And a lot of that is a real focus, short-term market share shift. What can they do quickly in their market to pull share from a competitor. So that's a very local landscape. They're renewing their focus for marketing. They're rethinking quick options around physician alignment. They're talking about how to improve service in their call center to make it easier for people to schedule and get in. These are all really short-term things. There's a lot of conversation around if we can't be one or two in our market, we need to really rethink what we're doing here. Interestingly, and at the risk of sounding a little schizophrenic, there's a renewed interest in partnership that are a little longer term, although not partnerships that we saw necessarily during the pandemic, health systems working with other health systems to talk about capacity across the market. I think this is more of a channel play, and so maybe some more non-traditional partnerships. If you look at some of the folks that are PE-backed and that are making moves, there are primary care groups, there are specialty aggregators. How might health systems work with them to quickly strike a deal and lock up a channel? So if you look at what ChenMed and Ohio Health have done, they went together to build some primary care centers in the Columbus area that's serving underserved areas of Columbus. That relationship focuses on some Medicare Advantage, dual eligible populations, intense care coordination, and of course, the downstream specialty care that's going to go back to Ohio Health. So that's a great channel play. They didn't have to build necessarily primary care centers on their own. They have the expertise of someone like a ChenMed to manage the centers and bring their care management, but they've locked up the channel. What are other partnerships that health systems might be able to execute that would allow them to establish themselves and grab share quickly? I think that's going to be front of mind too.
Jennifer, I'm glad you brought up that ChenMed example. The disruptors group here is broad, but there's other kind of primary care disruptors that are also not just targeting the same commercial suburbs most health systems target for growth. I think that's an exciting trend. And I hope one of the learnings coming out of 2020 was how much those underserved communities were underserved and that hopefully they look like priorities, growth opportunities, just like many of these disruptors have identified.
Your statements are all true.
When we think about growth, we really don't get anywhere without thinking about who is really fueling that growth and the ability to provide services, and that's the workforce. We've had a lot of focus on the workforce over the past couple of months, the burnout aspect of things, but there's some other things that are interesting to look at, specifically the makeup of the workforce. We're seeing a ton of contract labor nurses in the workforce. What does that mean for moving forward, both the logistical aspects of things when we're talking about scheduling scheduling, and then some of the longer term components like retaining talent. Jennifer, let's go to you first.
We're in our third surge now. The reality is it's happening across the country. And so the contract labor situation is pretty incredible. If we talk to our colleagues at Vizient, they are literally placing people in every market around the country. And in some places, we're talking about nurses getting paid $150 an hour. That obviously is a temporary situation, but what we've got to start to think through is what happens when those contracts are up. They're typically 13 weeks. Maybe they re-up, maybe they don't. Some of your workforce has opted to take advantage of what is a great financial situation for them, admittedly a huge physical and mental burden, but they're going to come back. And the question I think for organizations is, how do you position yourself to be the workplace they want to come back to? You're obviously not going to continue to pay them $150 an hour. No one's cost structure supports that. They're going to be exhausted, right? Let's acknowledge that. This has been an incredible lift for our workforce, and they may not be ready to come back full time. What we saw from some of our larger systems who had attempted to move toward real clinical scale, they had done things around centralized staffing. They had the capability of offering their workforce, particularly their nursing workforce, some flexibility. We had clients who had nurses who came in and covered a 4-hour shift. And you might think, 4 hours, what does that get you? But that gets you is coverage for your other nurses so they can go have lunch. Maybe some of these returning nurses need a little bit of a break. They need some flexibility. They need some part-time. They need to take care of their family. They've been away. Are you the organization that can offer them that flexibility because you have that organized staffing approach across your enterprise? I think that's one thing that's going to be really attractive. We know folks are going to return with the burden of this incredible work they've done. Burnout was a problem before. It will only be exacerbated now. And there were a couple of things we knew before the pandemic about burnout, right? You need to get past the idea that we're teaching stress reduction classes here. We really need to approach and support people personally. Those who've done really well with burnout have clear programs to help individual clinicians identify and support other clinicians who are encountering burnout. It's that personal. It's that level of support. It's also the commitment from the organization to fix things that don't work and get in the way of clinicians doing their job. There's going to be much less tolerance for the hurdles that get in the way of clinical care. And that actually is one of the issues that most affects burnout. It's the organizational inertia and saying, no, we're committed to fixing that so you can do your job as a clinician. It's the task force that looks at how many clicks you have to go through in the EMR to really document care of a patient. And we're going to have to renew ourselves to that work. I don't think our workforce is going to come back and, given everything they've been through, put up with that stuff. And I think there's also organizations who will be able to demonstrate that they were really a great place to be in the middle of such a serious time. They were transparent with their workforce about things around PPE levels, around the realities of infection levels. They built a real trust. And I think there'll be organizations who reap the benefit of that as they kind of reintegrate their workforce.
What I would add is that we don't have the data yet, but what we will find happened during 2020 is that medical practices finally leaned in to the capabilities of their advanced practitioners to change the productivity model, to triage patients, to have the first encounter. I suspect we've used our nurse practitioners and physician assistants far more aggressively and successfully than we ever have before across American healthcare.
I think it's a real positive change, Bill. We had multidisciplinary teams that really made the ICU work during a pandemic. And a lot of that was because advanced practice providers really stepped up and earned the trust of physicians who maybe hadn't worked with them before, didn't know their full capabilities. I don't see this one going back. I don't think those advanced practice providers will want to go back to more minimized roles. If your organization is one that can demonstrate APPs have a voice and they are allowed to work top of license, that should really position you well to welcome back this returning workforce and make you a destination for those folks to go.
Let's run through some of the stuff that's not going to return to normal. That's an exciting one to start with. Bill, what's something that's not going to return to normal next year?
You know, I'll defer to Henry and how to describe the digital journey for patients, but clearly the consumer's general expectations for the system for transactional care have accelerated or have permanently changed. That's a positive. That's an opportunity for disruptors and for our health system members. But let's turn it inside the inner workings of health systems. There's a certain command center mentality that got our members through a good chunk of last year. I think that stays in place, and it's not just operational day-to-day lifting. I think it affects how decisions are made. I am optimistic that health systems have figured out finally they have limited bandwidth and can only focus on a small number of priorities at any given time. That's incredibly refreshing, and that excites me about the strategic execution that can go on moving forward. And to be even more positive about this, health systems have learned they have a certain resilience that carried them through last year. We're going to watch for when the adrenaline finally wears off. I feel like there's energy in our world on the provider side and the health system administration side for what we can do next, how quickly we can get things done, how we can make decisions, and what we decide we're not going to do.
Henry, you want to weigh in?
I agree with Bill's comment about the digital journey, but I think the thing that we've been having conversations around that won't return to normal, at least this year, is around capital purchasing for technology. There's a limited budget that we've started out with, and as Bill indicated already, there's only a certain level of bandwidth that our health organizations can deal with at this point in time. In our conversations with our supplier and industry partners, they realize that that's going to be a heavy lift for them this year to try and convince health systems across the country that it's worth it to invest in some digital technology to allow them to get more aggressive in the consumer's digital journey around healthcare. The caveat around that is unless a supplier can show a return on investment that's closer to 12 months or 18 months, that conversation probably won't happen in 2021. And I think our conversations with our industry members indicates that they realize that, and they're fine-tuning their messaging to demonstrate real value in terms of outcomes, in terms of lowering costs, in terms of accelerating care. And that's the only way those purchases are going to be made this year.
Things that we don't expect to see return to normal from a very practical perspective, think of the volume shift in 2020, that ED volume hasn't rebounded and we don't see that happening. So ED business continues to be reshaped. Some of that goes to urgent care or to virtual, but that's going to look different moving forward. And the idea of care at home, this is no longer a small, interesting pilot a few organizations run. This is a substantial interest for, I think, every member I've talked to in the last 3 months. And if you couple that with the increasing population who are getting older with chronic diseases, and they've discovered virtual care and remote monitoring is a nice way to receive some of their care, and they can do that as they age in place. There was a fantastic op-ed in the New York Times on the perspective of what it's been like to be in a residential facility for the last 10 months and the number of people who are pulling their parents out of those facilities, bringing them home. They're not just setting them up in the spare bedroom temporarily. They are saying, we are no longer interested in our family member or loved one living in that particular setting. We will put them somewhere else, apartment nearby, in our house. And that just signals to me that care at home is really here to stay.
Great. What is something that you are optimistic about for this year and beyond?
What I'm optimistic about is that the science works. What we've seen is just an amazing level of effort to get us with machine learning and with generational adversarial networks to get the first two messenger RSNA vaccines out the door in less than a year. That's an amazing standard by anybody's thought process. That's been amazing, and it's going to continue for 2021. So we've already seen a report this year of people using a similar mechanism to be able to get us now to targeted therapies for patients with multiple sclerosis using messenger RNA vaccines. I think the fact that the science works, that we can leverage that and share that, will benefit patients in multiple clinical areas for 2021. And I think that's a testament to how people shared information and moved the process along really quickly.
Absolutely. Jennifer, what about you?
I am standing on the sidelines cheering for the report I just read that we have a Fauci effect. He was one of my favorite experts to listen to last year. And the reason they're saying that is because they've seen a double-digit increase in medical school applications. What a great outcome on a rough year to know that amidst all that, we have inspired a new generation of potential physicians to enter the healthcare field.
Bill, take us home.
I've got two topics. One is health systems have figured out that an asset-light view of the future will serve them well financially and serve their consumers better, which means we're going to be less concerned about the number of buildings, the number of locations, and more focused on the care delivery system itself, which is a topic we've addressed with a new approach to talking about the system of care, and more on that ahead for SU2 this year. And the second area is perhaps incredibly important, and that is health systems have recognized themselves and have been recognized in how they're able to address disparities in their local markets. We've been heartened to hear from our members embracing their role and how they plan to move forward and work with different organizations in the community to extend their capabilities to be truly indispensable for dealing with inequity and playing a positive role moving forward. I think that's a terrific outcome of 2020 and one that we expect to see more progress on this year.
And I'd offer up another one here. We expect continued increasing demand for behavioral health services. That's been true the last couple of years and will certainly accelerate coming off of challenges from 2020. And one of the best things I read recently is that there is increased investor interest in behavioral health. So PE and VC backing. And if we're really going to solve that complex challenge, I think that investment is going to be important.
Yeah, that reminds me of one final thought here. The move to shorter decision-making cycle times in 2020 really led to an increased reliance on analytics across our membership. And it was really exciting that our data tools were a big part of that. And I really expect that to continue through 2021. Henry, Bill, Jennifer, thanks so much for making some bold predictions at the beginning of a year with a lot of unknowns.
This has been another episode of SG2 Perspectives. If you like what you are hearing, please subscribe and don't forget to rate and review. We'd love to hear from you. Please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter at SG2 Healthcare. You can also reach us via email at sg2perspectives@sg2.com. Reach out and let us know what healthcare trends are most important to you. Please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.